This episode is brought to you by Tegas, where we're changing the game in investment research. Step away from outdated, inefficient methods and into the future with our platform, proudly hosting over 100,000 transcripts with over 25,000 transcripts added just this year alone. What sets Tegas apart? It's not just the sheer volume, it's the unmatched speed at which our library expands, consistently outstripping competitors. Our platform grows 8 times faster and adds twice as much monthly content as our competitors, putting us at the forefront of the industry. Our collection is investor-led, ensuring unparalleled quality and giving you access to questions and topics investors care most about. Plus, with 75% of private market transcripts available exclusively on Tegas, we offer insights you can't find elsewhere. Forget the traditional way of doing things. With Tegas, you have the most comprehensive, insightful, and rapidly growing transcript library at your fingertips. See the difference that a vast, quality-driven transcript library makes. Unlock your free trial at tegas.com/patrick. You may have heard me reference the idea of maniacs on a mission and how much that idea excites me. Well, David Senra is my favorite maniac on one of my favorite missions with his weekly crafting of the Founders podcast. Through studying the lives of legends, he weaves together insights across history to distill ideas that you can use in your work. Founders reveals tried and true tactics, battle-tested by the world's icons, and has David's infectious energy to accompany them. With well over 300 episodes, your heroes are surely in the lineup, and his recent episode on Oprah is particularly great. Founders is a movement that you don't want to miss. It's part of the Colossus Network, and you can find your way to David's great podcast in the show notes. Hello and welcome, everyone. I'm Patrick O'Shaughnessy, and this is Invest Like the Best. This show is an open-ended exploration of markets, ideas, stories, and strategies that will help you better invest both your time and your money. Invest Like the Best is part of the Colossus family of podcasts, and you can access all our podcasts, including edited transcripts, show notes, and other resources to keep learning at joincolossus.com.
Patrick O'Shaughnessy is the CEO of Positive Sum. All opinions expressed by Patrick and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Positive Sum. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Positive Sum may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. To learn more, visit psum.vc.
My guest today is Ken Langone. Ken is a legendary American businessman best known for his co-founding of Home Depot. He is also a former director of the New York Stock Exchange and a passionate philanthropist. He shares with us a lifetime worth of wisdom, building Home Depot into a powerhouse and prioritizing his employees above all else. He says he still bleeds orange to this day. You'll hear as he recounts his business endeavors, his strict belief in keeping your word, and his true pride in his country, what he knows to be the land of opportunity. We discuss his work with Ross Perot, the idea of an upside-down hierarchy, and the power of loyalty. For anyone who may find it easier to follow along, we have a transcript of the episode on joincolossus.com. Please enjoy this conversation with Ken Langone. So Ken, it's hard to know where to begin a conversation with you, given the number of interesting things that you've done across your life, your career. I saw when researching your history, so many interesting early anecdotes with you establishing yourself, especially in your work with Ross Perot. And I always found Ross to be such an interesting character in business history. I'd love to hear the story of you taking his business public and what that represented to you at an early stage of your career and what it was like to work with him.
I happened to be at a Mardi Gras ball in Washington. And at the party, I met a fellow there by the name of Jack Haidt. And he and I hit it off. And he was telling me that he was partners in a company that was getting ready to go public. And they had a hell of a record. And I said to him, is there any chance I can get a chance to pitch my firm to be the underwriter? He said, let me see what I can do. We had a good time that night, drank a little bit, raise a little hell. Monday, he called me up and he said, you got an appointment in Dallas at 11:30 on Wednesday. Two things I want to tell you. Don't be late. You got 30 minutes. When the 30 minutes are up, leave. And don't swear, because I've been swearing like a sailor at this party. So I took two kids with me out of a corporate finance department. I say kids, I was only 33 myself then. And we went down to Dallas. The scariest thing was exactly at 11:30, I got into his office. And there he was sitting behind a big desk. He's diminutive. And He could have gone, "Hi, fellas. Come on over here. Sit over here and have a little chat. How you all doing?" I said, "We're doing fine, Mr. Perot." I said, "This is Roger Green. This is Duke Glenn." So we sit down. He lists the firms that he met with: Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, White Weld, Chitter Peabody. Every one of the top firms of Wall Street was there to see him. He talks nonstop for 29. Goldman says this, Merrill says that, Chitter says that, White Weld says that. And he says, "What do you think of that?" I'm looking at it, I got 30 seconds left. I said, "Mr. Perot, I think I'll just take advantage of the time I've got left to say goodbye, and I hope you'll see me again sometime." "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, Jack High told me I had 30 minutes, and right by my calculation, it's 30 minutes. Forget that. Tell me what you think." And I thought to myself, "Well, I'm going to blow the 30-minute rule. I might have to go all the way." I said, "Mr. Perot, that's the biggest pile of bullshit I've ever heard in my life." And he backs me to the back. I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Mr. Perot, this whole process is fairly simple. You're going to pick somebody who's going to tell you what he thinks you can sell your stock for. And your bet is, can they deliver on that number?" I said, "It's that simple." That's what all the talk they have about working the market, knowing the market, doing this, all those things. He said, "Well, that's interesting." He said, "Let's talk a little bit more." We talked until 1 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Driving me and two guys. I was in the front seat. He had a big maroon Lincoln, and he was driving us all over Dallas. We were going to go back on a 3:30 plane in the afternoon. Now I figured, "Oh, I'm not going to throw this meeting in." We were looking for a drugstore. We could buy shaving gear and toothbrush and stuff, like maybe even a t-shirt, because we brought nothing down. We finally found a place. We stayed at a hotel. He was going to make a decision by the following Friday. And he called up. He said, "I'd like to get to know you a little bit better." He said, "Come on back down." So I went back down. And we talked and we talked and we talked. I had not seen one number on how much his sales were, what his earnings were, nothing. So he invited me back down. "You got a chance, come on back down." I talked to you. I said, "Sure." So the third time I went down alone. He picked me up at the airport. We're driving back to his office. "Ken, have you given any thought to what you think we're worth?" "Mr. Perot," I said, "first of all," I said, "I haven't had the benefit of your numbers. Let's assume the numbers are great." I said, "Can I get some kind of relevance?" We got into his office, and he had a closet, and on the inside of the closet door, he had a graph, a chart. I didn't know what the numbers were. All it was a chart of the percentage growth of the earnings and of the sales. And it was doubling every year. And I said to him, I knew what the business was. By now I got a good understanding. I said, "Based on those numbers, and if I could be made comfortable that they can continue that way for a while, I would argue your company's worth 100 times earnings." "What?" I said, "Yeah, about 100 times earnings." "Are you sure?" I said, "Well, Ross, I'm not sure of anything. I'm sure of this. Those numbers are what you say." I had no idea whether it was 5 million or 9 million. Well, it turns out it was 7 million of revenues and 3 million of pre-tax profit. It was a staggering margin. And the clear prospects that it continued its ascent. So he thought, "I want to think about it." I left about 2 weeks later. What he had done was he was calling all the other firms up and said, "Okay, what do you think I'm worth?" They settled in around 30 times. Now, when did May call me up and he said to me, "Are you comfortable with what you said?" I said, "Ross, I'll say it again. That you can continue this progression. You just do simple math. You got to cut the multiple every year by two. So it's not going to take long to get this thing down to 25 times earnings." But I said, "I won't be able to tell you that until I can get a better fix on the business." So he said, "Well, come on down, bring some guys down. Let's get to know each other better and talk about how we do things." He brought in a bunch of guys, one after the other. I swear to God, he has some kind of machine that created these guys. It was unbelievable. One more talented than the other. One man, common sense, plain spoken, gentleman. Don't forget, he had a dress code, white suit, white shirts, no tassel loafers, wingtip shoes, highly shined, no facial hair, military style haircuts. And the more I got exposed, the more excited I got. So he said, "Okay, well, let me think about it." This comes into June. 2 weeks later, he called me up. "Ken, Mitch Hart and I have been talking. One of the things we expect the people You know, we tell you, we're optimistic people. And very frankly, he said, Mitch and I are a little worried that you don't show much enthusiasm. I'm going, what the? I said, Ross, I'll be on the next plane down. What are you talking about? I said, I've never seen anything like this, and I've told you that. Well, I know I don't, Ross. I'm coming down. No, no, don't come down. He said, you know, we Texans have a good rule here. We think if you got a good sense of humor, you're a good Texan. I said, well, goddammit, you guys were a pain in the ass, too, okay? So anyway, he gives me the deal. The rest of Wall Street is stunned. Here's this little pissant railroad farmhouse getting the most sought-after piece of business probably in the last 5 or 10 years. And we go through the whole process. He wants to know how we're going to do it. I go, Ross, I'm going to make you one promise I didn't tell you before. I'm personally going to be on every meeting with every investor. I said, I intend to deliver. Are you sure? Oh, I know. He calls me up at the very end and decided he's going to give me the business. One of the firms that wanted it was G.H. Walker. There was a guy there by the name of Jerry Lodge, who he knew and who he liked. When Lodge heard that we were going to do the deal at 100 Time Journeys, he said, Ross, we'll go to 100 Time Journeys and we'll be co-managing with. So Ross called me up and said that he'd gotten this call and how did I feel about having a partner? I said, Ross, let me ask a question. And then you and I are in a high racing speed car going 200 miles an hour. I got the steering wheel and you got the brakes. We're sitting next to each other. How long before we're going to hit the wall? Because we're going to hit the wall. I said, Ross, if I'm going to go 200 miles an hour, I got control of the clutch, the steering wheel, shift, everything, or I ain't getting in that car. I understand. I said, Ross, you want to give them the deal. If you're more comfortable with them, you give it to them. I'm going to be around. I'm sure we'll figure a way out for you and me. No, sir, he said, you were the one that made him go from 70 to 100. You're my man. Let's go. We spent a whole summer getting the prospectus together, and the more I learned about it, the more excited I got. I had a home run here. Now, back then, New York State had a stock transfer tax. When you sold stock, there was a tax. And the way you get around it with an underwriting, you go through the tunnel after midnight on the day of the deal, sign all the papers in Jersey, and drive back in. So the deal was done in Jersey. It was legal. The night before the underwriting, Elaine and I and Margot and Ross had dinner at 21. We got to know each other that summer. We really hit it off personally well. By the way, I'll tell you, one of the great joys of my life was his friendship. And this is an aside. One of the great honors of my life was when I got the call from the family, Ross Jr. They'd like me to deliver a eulogy at his funeral. Wow. Me. So anyway, we're driving through the tunnel. Elaine went home because our kids had to go to school the next day. We had three kids. So we're in a limousine. By the way, the limousine driver was always a witness signing the paper. So this was all legal stuff.
I love it.
So we're driving through the tunnel. It was a back seat where you had two seats looking at each other. Margo and Ross are looking ahead. I'm sitting with my back to the front, looking at them. Well, he said, Margo, all the other guys on Wall Street told me now the ones he's going to back away from what he said he's going to do. What are you talking about, Ross? Well, I'm told, Ken, this is when you guys say, sorry, Ross, I miscalculated. I can't do it at the 100 times earnings. I got to do it at a lower number. What are you talking about? He said, well, I suppose this is when you're going to tell me I'm not getting the 100 times earnings. I said, how'd you know that? See, Margo? See, Margo? I said, how'd you know that? What do you mean? I said, I'm not going to do it at 100 times earnings. I'm sorry. See, Margo, there you are. They're all alike up here. They get us country boys up here. They pick us clean. I said, wait a minute. Does 100 times earnings mean that much to you? Damn right. He says, Texas, you put your hand out of your word as you bought. It means a lot to me. Not just the number, but the fact you kept your word. I said, Russ, look, the last thing I want is an unhappy client. We'll do it at 100 times earnings. Damn well you will. I said, okay. So Margo, I winked at Margo while he was in a little bit of a tizzy. She says to me, God bless Margo, she's sharp. She said, well, Ken, what were you going to do it at? I said, well, I was going to do it at 115 times journey, but if he only wants 100 times journey, it's okay with me. We did it at 115 wow. times journeys. And by the way, it went from 16 to 24 the first day. So it was a very successful deal. And that deal, for lack of a better way to describe it, put me on the map. The most important thing of all was he was a man who, when you delivered it to him and you kept your word, he never forgot it. So he became perhaps my staunchest advocate. I was a young kid, 33. I'd never done an underwriting. that friendship has lasted all through his life and now with his family as well.
What about his style do you feel is most lacking in the world of leadership today, if anything?
Integrity. That's it. The man was maniacal about keeping his word. And the second thing would be loyalty. If you promised two and delivered four, he'd never forget it. And this is bad.
One of my favorite ideas of yours is this notion of leaving more on the table for the other guy than you think the other guy thinks he deserves. Did that come from Ross?
No. Let me tell you where that came from. That came from my experiences as a poor kid when I realized if somebody expected this of me, I gave him that plus something. And to me, the art of negotiating is not see who bests who. The art of negotiating to me is to get a deal for yourself to make sure the guy you're dealing with feels he got more than he thought he was going to get or he should get. 100 times earnings to 115 times earnings. I can't think of a deal I've done where I couldn't have got more than I got. That's okay, because the element of trust is the most precious thing in living. If I trust my doctor that he's going to do the right thing for me, there's a better chance he's going to be more candid with me and more willing to try and help me, whatever my condition is, or a friendship or a marriage. I don't care what it is. I'll give you a for instance. I did a deal with a guy. I bought a company. He was a tough negotiator. He negotiated back and forth, and I virtually gave in on every point. We got done around 9:30 at night, my office. I said, "No, you say, oh, I'm happy. I couldn't be happy." Okay. I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. Let's go back, and I'll drop you off in a hotel, and I'll pick you up in the morning. We'll have breakfast. We'll talk some more." I said, "Okay." So the next morning, I pick him up. We're driving to my office. He said, "Ken, can I be honest with you?" I said, "Please do." He said, "I'm sorry." He said, "As I reflect on this, I don't think this is a good enough deal for me as I'm entitled." I said, "Well, let's go upstairs." And I said, "Okay, where do you think this thing is deficient for you?" And he tells me, "It's okay, you got it." "What do you mean?" I said, "Tell me what you want, you got it." "I said, I want to tell you something else. I will never do this with you again. You bargained hard all day yesterday. You assured me at the end of the day it was exactly what you wanted. You were fairly treated." I said, "I can't think of one point I didn't concede to you." I said, "I'm sorry. You got what you want in this deal, but I never wanted the business with you again. And I feel strongly about that." And the best testimony is I never had a fear of client or a potential partner in a deal saying something bad about me because I did okay. I always hope that I do okay. Considering where I started and sitting where I am right this minute. And it's okay to bargain for it. But when you're done, you're done. And he was shocked. I said, "You got your deal. You got exactly what you want. Now you got it." Frankly, I said, "I thought you had a great deal last night, but obviously you thought there might be more on the table, so I won't disappoint you." By the way, that company turned out to be a home run. We did okay. So that's the philosophy of life. I pride myself on that. I think there's nothing more precious in my life other than my family than my word.
Was there an early formative experience, like a specific experience that most taught you that lesson? How did you come to that conclusion? It sounds like at a really young age.
My mother and father, they were humble, uneducated, but incredibly honorable people. But just how they lived their lives, that was really where it was chiseled home to me. You know, keep your word, work as hard as you can and give it all you got. And live by the golden rule. One of the things that I feel strongly about is I'm very forthright about my job because that's where it all started. Then I had a good fortune meeting this lovely lady. She was 16 and I was 18. We got married when she was 18 and I was 20. And almost 68 years later, we're still hanging around with each other. We got pretty good.
What's the key to doing that well?
Have your fights, but never carry a grudge. Don't go to bed pissed off. We were two kids that truly loved each other, and the charm and success wouldn't change us, and I hope it hasn't. I urge my kids to be genuine, to be authentic, but that to me, very important being with.
Life and business is a repeat game. The story you just told about not doing the second deal with that guy, even just the way you've created successful financial outcomes seems to have been by holding longer than anybody else.
Loyalty, if I would like to be remembered for one thing, only one thing, I'd like to be remembered that I was a loyal friend, a loyal husband, a loyal father, whatever you want. Loyalty is in short supply. The world has become very transactional. My epic battle with Elliot Spitzer, which I whooped his ass, I can tell you right now. He ain't coming back for more, I can tell you right now. He ain't coming back for more. I got his ass good. And it was a fight that I loved every single second of it. But there, people were saying to me that I showed my loyalty to Dick Grasso. I said, no, in that case, by the way, it wasn't just loyalty. It was the facts. The facts were that the whole committee, all nine of us, always voted unanimously to give them these pay packages, which, by the way, were magnified because every previous chairman of the stock exchange never had a tenure chart of longer than 10 years. So I know when you got these deals every year, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, paid. Dick Grasso started at the exchange as an $82.50 a week union clerk. Went from that all the way to the chair. Guess what? He had 37 years of service. So when you put the yardstick to that, whoom, hell, that's what you wanted. He created it that way to get people to stay. And look what he did. When he took over, they had 1,200 listings. When he got the bullet in his head, he had 2,800 listings. He made all of us. I bought seats for $72,000 a piece. I got $8 million from each one of them. I mean, how bad a deal is that? We had guys on the floor of the exchange going out with it. The whole key to the exchange was listings. But people say, well, that was loyalty. Yeah, it was loyalty, but more importantly, it was being loyal to the truth. I knew the truth. The truth was every single member of that committee knew exactly. And that was a sad thing to me, that under the high-powered guys that withered under this guy's, oh, he is Spitzer. Bring him on, baby. I'll show you how withered. Okay? Bring him on. He did. He got it. What was that fun? I didn't want it to end. When Cuomo replaced him as AG, and when the Court of Appeals found in our favor 7-0. Cuomo called me up, and it was a Wednesday. That's when the decisions came out. He said to me, you know, he said, give me some advice. He said, I'm thinking of appealing it. I know he's playing with my head. He says, I'm thinking of appealing it. What do you think? I said, well, there's two things I think. Number one, the most joyous thing I could hear is the fact you're going to appeal it, that the game goes on, because I'm having a hell of a time in my life. And number two, you haven't got the balls to appeal it. He and I became good friends, by the way. So loyalty's in short supply in the world.
The idea about loyalty rings through the Home Depot story in such an incredible way. Like so many stories of people kind of like Grasso starting as a cashier and becoming, you know, a senior executive. I would just love to hear the beauty of the long term at Home Depot as you've experienced it as a co-founder and now incredibly long-term holder of that business.
The most precious thing Home Depot has are the kids on the floor with the orange aprons on. We had what we call the most corporations have a triangle that the base and the point at the top, and the point at the top is where the CEO is, and the base is where the newly hired employee is. We turned it upside down. We say the most important person in the company is the person that comes in touch with the customer. If that customer gets what he wants at a fair price and feels he got great service, he's never going anyplace else again. The most precious part of that equation there, I call him a kid. Anybody under 88, I'm 88 years old. I tell him, you're under 88, you're a kid. So don't get pissed off. Those kids, really challenging jobs. They need to learn what they're selling. They don't have the luxury of not being able to handle the difficult customer. They have crazy hours. And most of them are starting right at the bottom without a college education. And those kids made this company. If there's one thing Home Depot is known for, it's our service. Big thing. We give you great prices, no question about that. We're always in stock, no question about that. We have every imaginable item you can want in a given category, so you got assortment. But the thing that holds it all together is a kid that's dealing with you. I'll give you a for instance. This is a good friend of mine, customer. His faucet was dripping. When he turned it off, it was still dripping, meaning that the washer had failed. So water got through where the valve was, into the nozzle of the faucet, and drip, 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 drip. 3 o'clock in the morning, and your wife kicks you and says, go get the faucet. I can't sleep. The drip is keeping me awake. Guy gets up in the morning. He goes to the Home Depot store. Says to the kid, I need a new one of these. The kid says to him, a new one of what? He said, I need a whole new stem leaking. He said, no, you don't, sir. He said, you need a wash. Come on with me. We have little glassine bags of assorted size washes. Kid takes 25 cents, 30, I don't know if that's cheaper. Takes it off the peg, opens it up, gets the right size washer, has a screwdriver in his apron, takes it off, unscrews the screw, takes the bad washer out, takes the good drop washer, puts it in, puts the screw back in, and he says to the guy, here, go home and we'll drip it anyway. Guy's, what do I owe you? He said, nothing, sir. He said, happy you came to Home Depot. 3 months later, the wife wants a new kitchen. She's going to go to one of these foo-foo joints, kitchen and bath guys. She said, oh, no, we'll go to my friend. They went back. They found the kid. Kid brought him over to the kitchen designer where we sell kitchens. We got $100,000 kitchen order. That's the value. And we make an effort to train the kids. We make an effort to treat them fairly. Last year, unilaterally, we raised wages $1 billion. Across the country. Why? Because we really feel for our kids. They own stock. Well, I guess I could say I made some money.
Just a bit.
I should be. I'll tell you this. The greatest number of all to me is not my network. We have 3,000 kids that are still working for the company today. 3,000 of them. They started out pushing carts in from the lot. They're multimillionaires, and they're still working for the company. You want to talk about culture carries? Trust me, that's the value of treating your people right and taking care of them. We do everything we can for them, and they know it.
What in the history of Home Depot went the most wrong, and how did you fix it?
Well, the thing that went most wrong was a mindset that cost was more important than culture. How did we fix it? We changed leadership. That's simple. Frank came to the company, I'm going to guess, around 2003, 2004. At that point, we were 23, 24 years old. But I would call Frank Blake the founder of the company. Why? Frank restored the culture. He led by example. No doubt about it. His selection as CEO was, I think, the smartest decision, and I take great pride in that personally, because when we were constantly decided that we had to go different ways with Bob, by the way, give Bob credit. First 40 years, Bob was with the company. Everything he touched, he made better. Everything. However, once we got past that 4 years, he started to now get a little too aggressive, and I think got away from the culture. Frank was not a popular choice. It's a natural. And the reason Frank is a natural is he embraces the finest of values a human being could have. 1 year, Frank didn't even want to take a bonus. We're just getting this thing going right. I don't need a bonus this year. Frank is selfless, Frank. First of all, he's smart as a threefold owls. He graduated from Harvard, Columbia Law School graduate, clerk to Justice Stevens of the Supreme Court, throwing on it in a year. Number two or three guy, and I think Department of Energy. Comes to Depot to work on strategy, and nerdy kind of guy you meet him. He'll never get a prize for being a picture of sartorial splendor, okay? And I say that because I tell him, I mean, that's Frank's charm. What you see is what you get. And I talk about being authentic. He is the best example of authenticity I can imagine. So culture is there, is it? Interesting aside, when I was there to take a job at NYU Medical Center, places at a shambles, broke, morale was terrible. They just merged their hospital with Mount Sinai. And ironically, here's an example of bad faith. Each side fucking screwing the other side. They were getting rid of a bad hospital. We took two bad hospitals and made it one huge bad hospital. The element of distrust was palpable. So when I took the job, I went and I said to Barney, look, if you want me to do this, yeah, really bad. So I need help. Barney was chairman of the university. Really bad. Yeah, but I really need help. I said, okay, Marty, then I want the hospital back. I want to send you Murray's. I said, it's not going to be easy. Legally and technically, it was a difficult thing. We did it. And I think we at Home Depot, we, Bernie and Arthur, myself and Pat, we put this culture in place day one. We lived it. We lived it. I tell people here I had highly educated, double degree, triple degree doctors. And the same thing I did with a 18-year-old kid that barely got out of high school, with this professional, highly accomplished, fabulous doctor, treated him the same way, and it worked. Just guess what? The human beings at the end of the day. Gotta celebrate hourly people on the floor. They are the key to the, this is the magic sauce. Okay, this is a secret sauce. Not so much of a secret, but it takes effort, it takes time, and you try to do everything you can to let these kids know that they really matter, that they can make a difference, that their opinion, share with us your ideas, share with us. You'd be amazed the number of great ideas we had that we implemented in the stores that came out of the mind of a kid that barely got out of high school. We encourage them to be open, to come express themselves. Tell us, I give you, for instance, we were opening a store in Elmont. So the Wednesday before the store's got open, I'm in there, and the kid in the plumbing department comes up to me. He said, are you somebody in this company? Said, yeah. Come on, I'll show you something. He said, I'm curious, were you guys born stupid or did you become stupid? Okay, I said, maybe it's a combination of both. But you don't want these kids to feel intimidated or threatened. You want to get it out of their head. I says, okay. So he takes me over and he shows me a big cardboard box that's on the floor at the bottom of the rack. And in the box are a bunch of plungers. We got to stop them throughout. He said, you put your hand in that box, you think you were in a coal mine, you come out black. I said, so what? He said, nobody sees the plungers. Now, think of this. You don't wake up on a Saturday morning and say, hey, honey, let's go to Home Depot and buy a plunger. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, the toilet stopped up, and you haven't got a plunger. You get your ass to the Home Depot store as soon as it opens to get the plunger. So back to the kid, I said, okay, what would you do? He said, I'd get pipe hooks, like in a gun store, you know how they show guns on a wall? And I put the plungers at the end of the thing on a rack. Why don't you do it? He said, can I? I said, why can't you? You think it's such a good idea? Why don't you do it? Okay. Saturday morning at 11 o'clock, the store is now open. People clap. And I see the kid, come on, come here, come here, come here. It's like, well, there's no plungers in the pipe cooks. I said, oh, you put them back in the box? No, there's no. Hey, honey, $3. Plunger you can buy for $3.54. Hey, honey, we need a plunger. I don't have a plunger. You made it an impulse item. That was out of the mind of a kid that barely got out of high school. You don't know where you're going to find a gem. But you're never going to find them if you don't look for them.
What do you think was the reason you've been able to hold on to these investments, these positions for so much longer than everybody else? I saw the average length of your investments is 35 years or something crazy like that.
Stop it, 42 years.
42 years, sorry. I don't want to take that.
I'm stupid. Because I'm stupid. I'm loyal. I'm even loyal to my investment positions. What am I going to tell you? You know, you're loyal, you're loyal. Look, I got my Lilly stock 2 years before Home Depot was founded, a little medical device company they bought. I got to know the management people. I liked them. You know, they were solid Midwestern people. The guy that I negotiated the deal with was a tough son of a bitch by the name of Gene Stepp. But I had such admiration and respect for Gene. I had no doubt that Lilly would turn out to be a great company. Now, it didn't hurt that if I'd sold the stock, I'd have had a hell of a tax. Because my cost basis, the little device company I took over in a proxy fight, Ready, had a market cap of $1.5 million. Okay? Had a market cap, $1.5 million. Lilly gave us $50 million. That was a proxy fight. It was May of 72. Lilly gave us 1.5 million shares of Lilly stock worth $37.50 a share of our stock, per share, roughly that. And Lilly paid a dividend. So the dividend was a nice thing, the little bit of income. The Lilly stock has split over those all those years from 77 to now, 16 to 1. So the 1.5 million shares, 6, 9, is 24 million shares. Okay? You ready now? $18.36 billion. Now catch this. Lilly stock from 77 to 02 went from 37, it got to as high as 109. From 02 to 18, the stock did nothing. It was a 109 in 02, and it was 109 in 18. However, going back to 77, November 30, 77, until last August, counting the dividend, including the 16 years of nothing, it compounded at 15% a year. You're a home run. Every stock I own compounded at 15% a year. I spent a lot of time with companies. I get to know the managements. My first and my major and my principal concern is people. I bet on people. I've got a Home Depot position now. I got literally 47 years. People, I got 46 years. J.P. Morgan, I bought the warrants, but I bought them way back. I got my J.P. Morgan stock today, 16 years. I got my Parker Hannifin, 16 years. They're puppies. They're still babies. I've got a new position called Option Care Holdings. I bought it 6 years ago, and I'll be there with them. As long as the management stays quality people, as long as the prospects of the business are bright, it's like my wife. These guys, you get married 3 and 4 times. How do they remember who to, what to call them, what name to use? I mean, can you imagine? Jane, Mary, Pat. Life is simple. And holding on to these situations, you know, the food I ate as a kid is still my favorite food, peasant food.
What's your death row meal?
Pasta fagioli.
What's your last pasta fagioli?
Escargot and meat and beans, plant parmesan, fried peppers and potatoes. Oh, God, they cook fried peppers and potatoes. And I got my mother, God, she was so cook. But those are my favorite foods. I got a little dive in Port Washington. I go to DiMaggio's, great pizza, bowl of pasta fagioli or a bowl of escargot and beans. Man, it's like dying and going to heaven.
What do you love most about capitalism? I love that title of your book. If you had to sum it up, what do you love most?
The good it does for mankind. Good it does for them. Look at our society. Look at every other country that moved towards socialism. Look at what's happened. Venezuela, Cuba, Argentina. Look at them. Brazil. Look at them. Look at Europe. Look at Europe. Hey, look. A poor kid working his ass off with a shot at the brass ring, he may never get it, but he's going to do a lot of good along the way, even if he didn't get it. Well, I'll give you for instance. You got a call one day for a kid. We opened our first Tamar Allen in the late 80s. I walked the store. He was working at one of our first stores on the island. Bam came in and says to me, Marcy, you got to come see you today. Okay. And I have a rule. Home Depot employees can first at Bernie called me. And it was another call for the kid. I said, fellas, I'll call you back. I got to talk to this kid. So the kid comes in that same day. Hi, Mark. What's up? He said, I wanted to let you know, I thought you should know. He said, this morning, I got a call from my Merrill Lynch broker that my Home Depot stock is now worth $1 million. I'm a millionaire. And that's fabulous. He said, let me tell you something else. He said, I paid my parents' mortgage off before. I paid my mortgage off. My two kids are in college, and I'm a millionaire. Do you know the impact that had on that kid and all those people in the store? He did it. I can do it. They got to work hard. You're going to have deals that don't always work. Anybody, if you got 6 months, I'll tell you all my bad deals. Everything is a home run. Oh, I'd be happy if they were break even, but you're going to get off the plate and take a swing. You ain't going to hit the ball every time. You're going to have a few strikeouts. That's life. But what does capitalism do? I think it offers promise. Me, a plumber's son, a cafeteria working son, not a very good student. Like I was a bad student. Look at what capitalism allowed me to do. You can't take that lightly. That's heavy duty stuff.
What did you see most commonly in the opportunity around Home Depot or other stuff that you got involved with early on beyond the people? Like, I know you were optimizing for amazing people. Was it just that?
That's 95%.
You weren't doing store fragmentation calculation for...
Right. You get into a bad idea with a great guy. The great guy's going to tell you it's a bad idea, we made a mistake. Hey, move on. Not everything's going to harm. I haven't got a crystal ball, but that's the key. Jesse Haddock was a golf coach at Wake Forest. One time I asked Jesse, what do you look for in a high school kid? people, the one thing I never do is I don't mess with their swing. If what they're doing and the results of their play gives them my attention, I get my attention because they got a great record, I leave them alone. I go, what are you looking for, Jesse? He said, I look for the kid that gets an iron on a par three. And the next hole goes back and birdies. You know, I look for resilience. And that's about it. I look for a management guy, Bernie Marcus, fired at 49 years old, no money, a mortgage, no health insurance. All right, let's go. Let's do it. Let's start it. Arthur, same thing. Pat Farrah, same thing. He just took bankruptcy. You want people that can bounce. You want people that can come back. They got fighting them. They got, hey, okay, that didn't work, but I'm going to give it a shot again. Home Depot led it. You realize Home Depot today has got a market cap of approximately $400 billion. $400 billion. Shit, that's a lot of money.
Huh? Not bad. What bad deal most stands out in your memory? We don't have 6 months, sadly, but we've got a few minutes. What bad deal is most memorable?
I did a deal that I got by virtue of, there was an article in Fortune magazine after the Pro deal. Had the title of the article, The Fastest, Richest Texan Ever, about Pro. And in that article, he was incredibly generous in describing me. And a guy called me up from Avon, New York, outside of Rochester. They were building modular homes in a factory. I went up to see it, and it blew my mind. I got so caught up in the moment of what they were doing, I failed myself to take a step back and talk about the people. But I did. And because I had a hot hand, there was nothing I could do that people weren't going to jump on. Those guys ended up all going to jail. Fortunately, I didn't know anything about it. They left me, we looked a deal for them. 1970 was a bad year. They left me and they went to Merrill Lynch. It's all about reputation. Always is and always will be. Nothing matters to me more than I was a member to keep my word.
Curious how the hospital thing resolved. It was a mess when you showed up and you oversaw it for a long time. And it's one of the best ever.
We're number one in America. We got a culture that won't stop. We're hitting on all cylinders. We got $3.5 billion cash in the bank. The greatest thing of all, we took over a rundown, broken down hospital in Brooklyn called Lutheran Hospital. The zip code has the highest percentage of welfare patients in the United States. It's the poorest zip code in the country. We don't make a nickel on that hospital, but that hospital on its own was now ranked number one. We have three hospitals, Long Island, Brooklyn, and Manhattan. We put all those three in separately. All three of them separately got A. Number one. How good are we doing? We're kicking ass and taking names like you can't believe.
Is it all culture?
100%. Oh, wait a minute. Whoa. Culture and making sure you bring the very best with you as you embrace that culture. We're number one in brain surgery. We're number one in neurology. In the top 10 in virtually every specialty you can name, urology, dermatology, you name it, we're there. How do we do it? We celebrate these people. We pay them well. Okay, we pay them well. But we're delivering a product second to none. A guy shot me the other day in a restaurant. I own a piece of a restaurant down in Boca called Gallagher's. It's unbelievable. That there's a good example. The kid that runs Gallagher's, and he's 67, I call him a kid. He bought that restaurant. It was doing $6 million a year in 2012. Last year, he did $30 million in business. One restaurant, home run. This year, he's going to do $33, $34 million in business. It's all about the people. Now, all I can say to you is, I say all the time, under promise and over deliver. But it's always about the people. And if you get those people to know, you're going to take good care. You got to be fair with them. It's critical. This guy in a restaurant the other night comes to me and he's going, go, you're Mr. Langone. Yes, I am. Your hospital saved my wife's life. That's a pretty strong statement. He said, no, I'm telling you. He's got tears coming down his head. I said, you know what you did? You just made my day. You made me feel like I'm somebody. How do we do it? Go to NYU and grab a guard. They think I'm a white job. I walk in and I say, to the security guy, the big security guy, you happy? Yeah, I'm happy. You like it? I love it here. Well, if you ever got a problem, I hope you know who I am. Call me up. And I prefer they call me Ken, by the way. Mystery is a barrier that blocks you from authenticity with each other. Call me whatever you want. Just don't call me late for an order. Okay? I mean, that would piss me off.
The last question I ask everybody is, what is the kindest thing that anyone's ever done for you?
Oh, God. I've got so many kind things done for me. I can't count them. I'll give you a for instance. Here's one thing. I worked in a butcher shop as a kid, among my many jobs. I had two or three jobs at one time. In fact, I worked in a butcher shop, and the guy that ran the butcher shop didn't know I worked for the supermarket down the street, down packing. I set the shelves up, and the store closed 9 o'clock at night. He'd have fired me if he'd known that there was this competitor. Anyway, next to the butcher shop was a liquor store. And the Orman family ran. Maybe we had five Jewish families in town. Ross. Lenny Orman, good man, came to me, said to me, "Hey, kiddies, you want to make a couple of bucks?" I said, "Yeah, sure. A couple of bucks, I'd kill you for a couple of dollars." "What do you want me to do?" He said, "I want you to, I got cardboard boxes that the liquor comes in. I put them up." He had a little porch back of a store. He says, "It's a garbage company. We'll come and take them. You got to take them down 150 yards where there's a spot where they pick them up. All you got to do is take the boxes. And they're there." And I said, "I'll give you a dollar a week. Do it two nights a week, 50 cents. You got it, Lenny." About 3 weeks after I'm doing it, one day I'm carrying the boxes. The guy on the garbage truck is there putting the boxes. But I noticed he's breaking the boxes up. "What are you doing with the boxes?" "Oh," he says, "they're worth a lot of money. What are you talking about?" "Yeah," he says, "I break them up and I tie them up and I take them to the junkyard and they buy the scrap paper. How much do you get?" He says, "Oh, I'll probably get $3 a day." "You kidding?" "Yeah." So I go back to Lenny. I said, "Lenny, we got a deal." I said, "If you let me break the boxes up, stack them in a pile on each other where the boxes broke, you got a lot of space. I'm going to tie them up with twine and you haven't got to pay me anything." "Why not?" I said, "Because I'll be able to sell it." "Okay. 2 to 4, make it $3, $4, $5 a week. Sell them the boxes." About a year after that, I'm walking past the liquor store. He said, "Hey, come here." He said, "Hey, you going to college?" I said, "Yeah." "Come on in." Takes me in. He had a counter and he had a little opening to the back. In the back, the shelf in the back of the counter. Here's a counter, here's a liquor shelf. In the back of that shelf, he had a little desk where he did his bookkeeping. Takes out a dollar. He says, "Here you go to college." And he said, "Who might need this?" He put a dollar a week in the envelope. For all those weeks, I was selling stuff. You talk about kindness. Hang on. There have been so many people who have been so kind to me, I can't count them. People are good. Talk about kindness. If you gave me a month, I couldn't have enough time to list all the people that have been good to me and kind to me. This is one of the reasons I believe in God. I really do. That's me.
Your story, your book, all your ideas, they're wonderful.
Remember this? Most important thing in that book covered, an American story. It only happened in America. This is the genius of America, that a poor kid rough around the edges like me could do okay. That whole promise that ain't not to the matter born, not with a silver spoon in my mouth, just the chance to live in this great country was all I needed.
I've so enjoyed our time together. Thanks for doing this with me. Cheers. If you enjoyed this episode, check out joincolossus.com. There you'll find every episode of this podcast complete with transcripts, show notes, and resources to keep learning. You can also sign up for our newsletter, Colossus Weekly, where we condense episodes to the big ideas, quotations, and more, as well as share the best content we find on the internet every week.